Maybe I just need to talk about postmodernism and get the anger going again.
Leninist Adam will return.
I know, that was the thing. I listened to that back and I was like, oh no. Oh, all my anarchist credentials are going out the window. I want to be clear. Basically, it was the historical materialism stuff that was important for me, because like I think Marx was right about that, right?
It was so wonderful listening to me. Like, I've never heard Adam sound so much like a strident Leninist. It's beautiful to hear you be like, maybe historical materialism.
Maybe I just need to own it. I just feel like the only way forward is with a Vanguard Party.
Hello and welcome to Bread and Rosaries, the leftist Christian podcast that is happy to report that due to its heroic actions, no harm has come to the Cenotaph. I'm Ben Molyneux-Hedrington, and I'm joined by Johnny Bell and Adam Spears. Say hi, Johnny.
Hello, me.
Say hi, Adam.
Hello.
Adam, thank you so much for representing the podcast as part of the patriotic forces defending the Cenotaph on Saturday.
It was quite something, wasn't it? Goodness me.
Yeah. I assume that's where you went. You said you were going to protest on Saturday, so I just assumed you were.
Yeah. No, that's very me, that, isn't it? Yeah, siding with the far right. I went down for the pro-Palestine / ceasefire / hate march. And
the pro-Hamas march, I believe.
Yeah,
is
yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was actually a really good turnout for the march. It wasn't a carnival atmosphere like I've had at some marches that I've been to. I mean, back when XR were sort of still semi-decent and I did a few of their things, that was a more kind of carnival atmosphere. But this was a much more kind of, it was definitely more of a protest than a kind of, I don't know, I don't even know how you'd compare the two, but... You see all these reports, the media focusing on all the anti-Semitism and stuff. Apparently there were 10, I don't know if it's 10 arrests, but 10 examples that they were able to find of people bringing anti-Semitic signs or something.
Yeah.
And obviously they focused in on that. I didn't see any anywhere. But it's interesting that they found 10, and that's the worst thing in the world, which, like, obviously any anti-Semitism is too much anti-Semitism.
But you always get dickheads at stuff like this. People, dickheads, take the opportunity, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And not just dickheads, but people who genuinely don't get it as well. And those people we need to deal with that, right?
Yeah.
But let's be clear. This march... the police say that it was a march of 300,000 people. The organizers say it was 800,000 people. It's quite a disparity between those two numbers. But either way, it's a huge march. And the fact that you found 10 people, right, that's the most you could find, right? Like, yeah, of course you did, because there's between three and 800,000 people. Of course there's a couple of dickheads. Of course there's a couple of anti-Semites. Yeah. I didn't see any. And if I had seen any, then I would have made my feelings clear on that.
Mm.
But it's just fascinating the kind of lengths that the media and those in power will go to brand people calling for peace as racists or hate mongers or whatever.
And I wonder at the moment how much, because obviously a lot of the rhetoric has been pretty far right coming from the government, and I wonder how much of people generally are starting to see it as such, and I wonder if that's what's fueled the huge turnout of going, hang on a second, this is outrageous.
So, I mean, 75% of the country, according to the polls, are pro ceasefire anyway, right? So the country as a whole absolutely does not agree with any of the main party leaders, with the exception of Hamza Yusuf in Scotland. And of course, that's because they're all just taking their cues from Washington. Hello, everyone. This is Adam in the editing booth here. Just dropping in a quick trigger warning to let you know that for about the next 4 minutes, we're going to be talking about some pretty graphic stuff in relation to Israel's ongoing genocide of the Palestinian people. So if you can't be dealing with that right now, do feel free to skip ahead by about 4 minutes and take care of yourself. But also, I think sometimes we're too quick to kind of draw a stark and clear difference between the liberals and the sort of social conservatives. And actually, there often isn't a lot of difference between them. Like Blue Labour, those social conservatives, those kind of redistributive social conservatives, are a sizable force in the country. But even most of those don't want to see dead babies on their screens. You know, even if I strongly disagree with a lot of what they believe in, I honestly think that most people are seeing what's going on and they ain't buying that narrative because they can fucking see it. I mean, today we saw that the bodies that have been piled up outside that hospital in Gaza that have been decomposing for days, and now they're putting them in mass graves, right? Because they haven't, they can't do anything else with them because Israel won't let them, right? People can see that. And when it's that clear, it doesn't matter whether you've got people like Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak and Suella Braverman, RIP. But it doesn't...
You're going to look like a prick if she dies in the next week before we release this.
Yeah, I will, but it won't be for saying that. You know, people see that, though, and they can see that kids and innocent people are dying on their TV screens, and they ain't buying, you know, they're not drinking the Kool-Aid that Starmer and Sunak and co are trying to feed them. People are not, for the most part, just inherently bad and nasty people. They have to be conditioned that way, and the human brain responds really effectively to imagery, to pictures, to videos, when they can see it for themselves and it moves them, right? In a way that actually rhetoric, as powerful as it can be, actually doesn't have the power to do. And so even people that I may disagree with them on so many of these things, that doesn't mean they're monsters. And actually, I think this is why I still believe that a lot of people can be convinced, you know, that a lot of people actually would agree with our sort of broad lefty bullshit if they could see it, if they could see the effects of capitalism, if they could see, you know, the program that we're really going for and what good it could do.
And it's interesting, actually, with when I think of the churches I've got and the conversations we're having, not just about this, but whenever I talk about essentially the effects of capitalism, but not naming it as such, because that often puts people's hackles up, they really, really think that things need to change. But the biggest stumbling block is the how that then happens, because they think that we can just all make a few tweaks here and there and it'll all be better. And it's like, well, no, getting energy light bulbs will not cease climate change. Getting some solar panels will not cease climate change and will make things worse for those who are mining the minerals for the batteries. You know, it's like...
I think this is one of the things that I find really frustrating with a lot of sermons, actually. I can tell that the people giving them are anti-capitalist, if not Marxist or anarchist or whatever it is. But they, because they have to, right, Johnny? This is what you've just been saying, right?
Yeah.
They have to skirt around the issue. And the closest you'll ever get is people saying things like hyper-capitalism or you know, they qualify
consumerism.
Consumerist capitalism. Like they will use a precursor to the word capitalism rather than just saying capitalism. I honestly think that we need to be clear that it's not this particular form of capitalism that's the issue. It is capitalism that's the issue. And actually, there's a very, very strong biblical precedent for saying that as well. And I think we just need to own that. You know, we're at the point now where we can't not anymore.
Indeed.
And I don't know if you've done this on purpose, Adam. If so, great podcasting. But that leads us on very nicely to what we're going to be talking about as the main topic of today's episode, which is to talk about particularly Christian pastors, celebrities, prominent Christians, tendency towards kind of both sides isms, to avoiding saying anything too particularly controversial, both in terms of, as you said, that avoidance of not wanting to name capitalism directly, but also particularly in the way that they have responded to the ongoing persecution of Palestinians by the State of Israel, where they obviously want to say something about it because it's big news and it's important, but they often shy away from saying anything too directly supportive of one view or another. So we're going to have a little think about what it is about Christianity and Christian culture that leads our most prominent Christians to avoid taking a side on things. But before we do that, as always, we're going to start off with our beloved segment, What Else Is On My Mind Grapes?
What else is on my mind grapes?
I'm never sure if it's beloved or beloved.
It depends how pretentious you want to be.
What's the more pretentious one?
Beloved.
Okay, so I was a man of the people.
Yep.
Okay, that's good. That's how I see it myself.
There probably is an actual grammatical reason for it, but...
So, I have got an article here called Why I Am Now a Christian, which I'm sure we'll be reading and celebrating, much as the farmer celebrates the return of his one lost sheep. We will be celebrating the return of this particular author.
Wow, you really missed your calling as a preacher, didn't you, Ben?
Profound, profound.
I'm a reformed preacher, not in the sense that my theology is reformed, as in I've left that behind. Like, that's...
You found a better way.
Yeah. This is in Unheard, which is a website that claims to deliver perspectives you've never heard before, which somehow always end up being conservative in ways that you've definitely heard before. But it's essentially a website that publishes long-form essays by the great and the good of conservatisms and liberals stupid enough to think that they're going to win people over by writing for a conservative website. It's founded by some people who are quite influential in kind of conservative politics. I think someone who did like Conservative Home or something, but I might be wrong about that. Anyway, so this article is by someone called Ayan Hirsi Ali. She was previously an ex-Muslim with like a medium level profile in the New Atheist movement. Not, you know, a Hitchens, Dawkins level Sam Harris type figure, but someone who was often further down the bill on their events, basically. And as both a woman and ex-Muslim, woman of colour, she obviously ticked a lot of diversity boxes that the New Atheist movement often struggled with for the obvious reasons. Anyway, so she's written this article about how she's actually leaving her New Atheism behind and she's converted to Christianity. And I'm just going to read a big chunk of the article because when I read it, it really hit me how much of this was just saying the quiet part out loud. So she says, "So, what changed? Why do I call myself a Christian now? Part of the answer is global. Western civilization is under threat from three different but related forces. The resurgence of great power, authoritarianism and expansionism in the forms of the Chinese Communist Party and of Vladimir Putin's Russia. The rise of global Islamism, which threatens to mobilize a vast population against the West."
Oh, the dog whistle was in this.
"And the viral..." Wait for it. "And the viral spread of woke ideology, which is,
there
eating,
it is.
Into the moral, eating into the moral fiber of the next generation."
Damn right.
"We endeavour to fend off these threats with modern secular tools, military, economic, diplomatic and technological efforts to defeat, bribe, persuade, appease or surveil." All right, Mrs. Thesaurus. "And yet, with every round of conflict..."
Mrs. Thesaurus, that is not what I would have gone with, you know. I mean, I was thinking, like, in terms of, like, the authoritarian aspect of that. You're like, no, no. "The most pressing issue here is the length of the words that she's used, not the content."
Well, it's more the, like, list of eight words that basically mean the same thing used to pad out the word count, which, as a failed academic, I recognise well. "And yet, with every round of conflict, we find ourselves losing ground. We're either running out of money, or we're losing our lead in the technological race with China. But we can't fight off these formidable forces unless we answer the question, what is it that unites us? The response that God is dead seems insufficient. So too does the attempt to find solace in the rules-based liberal international order. The only credible answer, I believe, lies in our desire to uphold the legacy of the Judeo-Christian tradition."
Oh, come on.
And that tradition, means that we need to colonize everyone and make everyone follow the same rules.
Hey, amen, preach, brother!
I mean, you two immediately picked up the dog whistle. She's literally doing woke mind virus stuff unironically. But I think there's something so revealing about, you know, really, she's not actually converted much. She's just labeling Christianity over the new atheism label, which amounts to
Western culture. It's Western culture. Yeah, that's what it
is. Western culture, anti-Muslim. I don't think actually much has changed other than she goes to church on a Sunday now and still believes the same dangerous stuff as before. But I think you're seeing more and more of this where a certain strand of Christianity is wanting to say, oh, there's scary people in the world. There's those commies and those Muslims and the wokes. And what we need is a good, strong Christianity that will unite us against these dangerous enemies.
Sorry, I just had really awful imagery when you were like, good, strong Christianity. Okay, that's what we're going with. Oh, yeah, Ben. Good, strong. Uh-oh.
No, it's the hench white Jesus, obviously.
Yeah.
So I've probably spoken about this before, but a lot of gay men, particularly white gay men, are quite racist and transphobic and sexist, etc. And a big part of that and the reasoning behind it is thought that it's about them aligning themselves with power. And if you align yourself with power and then, you know, and in doing so, you need to reject all the others who are lower than you, as it were, who have less power, then you will be safe. I wonder if that's happening here.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why you've got the police leading pride marches, right?
Yeah.
Because they've been assimilated into power.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think ultimately, as our t-shirt warns us about, this is just a form of Christo-fascism, really.
Yes.
That's some excellent, sneaky product placement in there, Ben. Yeah.
I didn't intend to do that.
BrettaRosaries.com/shop
Anything more to say on our newest sister in Christ?
Keep on doing God's work.
Let us move on to our main topic of the day, which is to talk a little bit about the both-sidisms, which is, I think it's a term that we use now, both-sidism. It feels very clumsy, but I'm just going to go with it. So we know that lots of our politicians are basically too cowardly to explicitly call what is going on in Palestine a genocide right now, or really to do anything other than equivocate on both sides. We know there's loads of reasons for this. There's the political pressure, as Adam mentioned earlier, particularly from our cousins in Washington. There's that fear of being smeared as an anti-Semite, which obviously, you know, not to discount the real dangers and presence of anti-Semitism in society, the smearing of people who were not anti-Semites as anti-Semites for their support of the Palestinian cause has only ramped up in recent years. And bluntly, just careerism for politicians. But I think we're also kind of seeing a trend, and I think actually possibly more prominently, or certainly more, not universally, but a vast majority of kind of what I might call professional Christians taking a very strong both sides approach in the public statement. I do want to say not all of them. I'm aware that I have someone who might fall into that category on the podcast right now.
It's a bit like saying not all men.
Yeah, yeah. So just imagine I keep saying except Johnny. But yeah, as a general rule of thumb, people are happy to talk about conflict and violence, but they tend to call it Israel-Palestine with an important slash in the middle there. And they focus really heavily on the civilian victims. And you hear very little about the politics or the kind of causes of what's happening. And I guess what we wanted to talk a little bit about is why is it that people who are publicly facing Christians, whether that's ministers or people who are theologians or, you know, public thinkers or whatever else, are wanting to have their voice heard on this issue in some ways, but end up charting directly down the middle and avoid placing any real blame anywhere, except maybe to say Hamas is bad.
I mean, I'm going to use what I did on Remembrance Sunday as an example. I think for me, one of the difficulties is if I go too far, it will just alienate and turn people off. So what I've been doing the past couple of weeks is kind of saying, it's awful, so what do we do about it? I have put together a little letter that I've sent out to people of sort of saying, you know, you can do these things, and here's what the Methodist Church says. But I also focused on Sunday on saying, well, what's loving? And a big part of that is about having compassion. And that's kind of what Jesus does a lot. He goes into the pain, towards the pain. And I ended up kind of talking about what people can do over the coming week and sort of focused in on prayer and praying for people who we hate, which is a really difficult thing for me to do anyway. And I've been doing it, praying for the Prime Minister of Israel, to know that, well, it was three things. To know that they are loved by God, to know that all people are loved by God, and to live with, what was it? Humility, equality, and justice, which seems really soft and fluffy, but actually I think there's something quite significant in doing that, particularly if you believe in a God who does intervene and is active in the world in some way. And also for your congregations, who are all predominantly, you know, my average age of my congregation is probably about 75-80, so they're not able to go to protests or anything like that, and writing to your MP is going to do jack shit, really.
Yep, as I found out when I got a response earlier this week, a kind of boilerplate response of Israel has the right to defend itself, Hamas are bad, etc., etc. Like, I lived on a kibbutz and so on and so forth. And that's a Labour MP.
But I do want to push back on that slightly and say that the point of sending a letter to your MP is not to change their mind, right? Mm-hmm. The point is that if they get a big influx of letter,
yeah,
it tells them that it's potentially politically dangerous for them to, at the very least, take a hard pro-Israel line, right? And sometimes that is, you know, with someone who is an MP who is pro-Israel kind of ideologically, the best we can hope for is to essentially scare them into fearing a backlash from people if they act on that too strongly, right? And so I think, yeah, we don't write letters to our MP. And, you know, I think that it has some value, but it's not necessarily the be-all and end-all. But any value it has is less in attempting to persuade our MPs into changing their mind so much as putting political pressure on them that basically, you know, if a few hundred people in your constituency had bothered to write a letter about this, how many people in your constituency didn't get around to writing a letter but care about it enough for it to affect their vote at the next election? That's the pressure you're putting on them, right?
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, last week was my Leninist episode. This week will probably be my more anarchist episode, because they're not there for us. No MP, even the better MPs, the system is constructed in such a way as, like, it's not possible for it to create the kind of society that we want, the kind of society that leads towards that kind of Christian understanding of, you know, God's love for all of those people and for justice and so on, right? So when I wrote to Preet Kaur Gill, MP, yeah, you're absolutely right. It wasn't because I thought that she would change anything or because I thought me writing that would help her to see the injustice of what's going on. One thing that her response did say was actually that she had hundreds of letters from people saying similar things to what I said. Now, her response to me didn't address any of the points that I made. It didn't say she was going to do any of the things that I suggested she did. Although, to be fair, one of them was resign, tell Keir Starmer to resign. So, you know, but actually that's the thing, because these people, that's their career and that's what they care about. Right. They care about climbing the greasy pole. They care about votes. They care about increasing their own power and access to power. And so I think anytime we deal with these people, that's the lens we have to view it through.
I think, speaking of career, I think it's really easy to say, oh, people aren't speaking out, you know, talking about the professional Christians here because of their career. But I'm also really aware, you know, again, you've got you here, Johnny, and you are, you know, technically you're still in training. I can't remember what the term is. I'm sorry.
That's on probation.
On probation. And, you know, if you got up in your pulpit and said it was right for Palestinians to use violence to defend themselves against an oppressive regime, a view that people may or may not hold, but just, you know, imagine, you know, the speed at which you'd be on the front page of the very least a local newspaper, and you might worm your way into a national tabloid. The chances,
not to mention the Methodist Recorder.
Yes, well,
is that what the most prestigious.
But, you know, actually, that is going to severely damage your ability to find a permanent job.
Well, it is different in the Methodist Church because we get stationed. So we go through a stationing process. The main issue might be that I'll be labelled as a troublemaker.
Yeah.
Right. You know.
No, sorry, I know.
You'll be labelled further as a troublemaker.
Yes. It's very true. But the bigger issue for me at the moment is because I'm still on probation. There's a chance that they can say no, and you sort of fail it, as it were. So that is the main reason why I'm not being as strong in what I'm saying, because there could be an issue. Because I know that my politics is very left wing, and it's not necessarily shared in the same way by all my colleagues, for example.
And I know that that was a pressure that I felt a lot, actually, when I was training in the Church of England until very recently. And actually, that's something I was going to ask you about, Johnny, because I think there's a fine line between what you were talking about earlier about being seen as relatively sensible and you know, being able to be taken seriously in the sermon that you deliver and whatever, and actually fear. You know, and I know for me, there was sometimes a fear that if I said things in a particular way, I mean, I've always been quite outspoken and people have known my politics, but I always had that slight fear that, you know, I had to be careful, A, of course, what I said in the pulpit, but B, you know, how I said it, because you might communicate an opinion that you strongly believe is a sort of gospel-based opinion, so to speak, in a way that doesn't align with that kind of liberal respectability politics.
Yeah. And I it is fair, actually. So if I didn't have to worry about that, I would be pretty outright saying explicitly what's going on. But I do occasionally, there's sometimes quite a power in asking a question. Which I'm slowly learning, because I'm not a very subtle person. I'm not necessarily, which might surprise people, but learning that subtlety of asking questions. Like the other day, I was talking with some people in my church and about Palestine, what's happening, and I said, "Well, what if you were to think of them more as freedom fighters?" And there was a real pause, and they went, "Oh," and they hadn't thought of it in that way before. And I kind of just left it, you know.
Yeah.
But there is a... Yeah, I think I would be much stronger in what I'm saying if I didn't worry about whether it would stop me from finishing this probation or not. Another way in, actually, that seems to be helping is talking about people's suffering and saying, this suffering is not okay. And it kind of bypasses some of the politics, which was actually what we were talking about earlier, isn't it? But, you know, before Mind Grapes. It helps people see the humanity, I think, rather than seeing a label of essentially being an other. And that talking about that direct suffering seems to make people see them as us rather than them.
I don't know if this is going to make sense, but to me, what you've just said, I don't disagree with it, and I think there's value in it, but I think it's... I wonder how much you think of that in relation to what you were talking about in our episode last week about, you know, being a Parisiastes, because being a Parisiastes is actually about being quite direct, about stating opposition to something or stating something as it is, rather than sort of trying to work things out through gentle debate.
I guess the difference between what I would do if I was being a Parisiastes is I'm not talking necessarily at who's causing it. I'm leaving a gap for people to fill. It's a bit like leaving the question. It's almost posing a question, you know, in a sense. It has the same flavor. I would love to say, look, the UK and the US are supporting one of the most powerful militaries in the world, oppressing some really vulnerable people. Like, what is it, 50%? Of Palestinians or people who live in Gaza are under the age of 15 or something like that.
Yeah, it's a crazy young population.
Yeah, and all the different things you can list at what's going on. I possibly will be doing that tomorrow, actually, in a midweek service of kind of going, this is one of the things that's happening, and not necessarily talking about bringing in religion, basically, but actually talking about the effects, I think, because it's factual, isn't it? I can't remember. It was when I was a guest on the podcast and I spoke about how I think that in Europe and the US, the reason why people became so pro-Jewish after the Second World War was not because they were pro-Jewish, but it was because they didn't want to be seen as being fascists and Nazis.
Mm. Yeah.
And there's a flavor of that still happening.
Yeah.
We are not Russian. We are not China. We are not Saudi Arabia. We're not Iran.
Yeah.
Which combined with the kind of conservative, American conservative evangelical kind of thing of backing Israel because of how you read Revelation means that it's a pretty potent force politically.
So let's move on now to talk about our saint of the week.
Saint of the week.
In the show notes, the saint of the week, it just says Johnny because I knew Johnny was doing it. But I realised that that actually means that according to the show notes, this week's saint of the week is Johnny. So without further ado, here is our saint of the week.
Not bloody likely.
Absolutely not. Something's gone very wrong here. Even more so than Diogenes and San Matthias. I have actually suggested two, technically, for this saint of the week. And they're also actually canonized, so they're technically actual saints.
It's just you making up for last week.
Yeah. Adam can't argue with these.
Watch me.
Well, if you do, Adam, and argue against them, you're going to be very homophobic. So maybe
you're sort of assuming that I'd be arguing against them because they're gay. I might be arguing them against them just because I hate you.
Sorry, just so we're clear, disagreeing with Johnny makes you a homophobe. That's the understanding.
Excellent. I'll use that whenever.
Tell us about Bacchus and the other one whose name I've forgotten.
Sergius and Bacchus. So these guys were quite early on, and they may not just kind of as we ever do it, they may not have actually been real or been confused with other people, but whatever. So 4th century, they lived roughly around then, and they were actually Roman soldiers.
Boo.
So yeah, but they had recently converted to Christianity, and
yay.
It's not quite pantomime season yet.
I was just gonna say, yeah. And they basically were quite conspicuously absent from participating in a ritual to sacrifice to Jupiter, and they were quite insistent about not going, and they were kind of found out that they were Christian, and the Roman emperor had then sent them to Mesopotamia, and they were actually tried by one of Sergius's old friends, someone called Antiochus. And he tried to kind of convert them back to the sort of Roman religions, but the two rejected what he was trying to say. And actually Antiochus had Bacchus beaten to death.
Good friend. Good friend.
Absolutely.
Also, is it not pronounced Antiochus? That's how I've always heard it.
It probably is. I've only ever read it.
Okay. Well, also, I mean, probably any way we pronounce it in, like, modern English is just wrong.
Yeah. I'll say Antiochus, but that does sound better than Antiochus.
We'll just splice it in.
Great.
You could just say Antiochus in multiple different ways quickly so we can, like...
Antiochus. 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 Antiochus.
Oh, Antiochus.
I think I'm editing this episode and I cannot be bothered to edit that in.
Yeah, and after Bacchus had died, the next day his spirit appeared to Sergius, encouraging him to persist so that they could remain together forever, presumably in heaven. And of course, history would say that they were the best of friends. And Sergius did persist, but then he was tortured and killed. Some of the oldest texts describe them as being Erastai or Erastai. Stat. Erast. Ah, fuck it. Which is... I'm not going to even try. Which is ancient Greek for lovers. However, that word is also used for the pederastic relationships where an older man would court and teach basically an adolescent boy. So it could have been that kind of relationship, particularly being in the army, that kind of does kind of fit. However, there have been some more recent historians and theologians kind of saying that they actually had a Christian ceremony called Adelphopoiesis, which is literally brother making. Interesting with this specific practice, there are Catholic records that date until the 14th century, and there are Orthodox texts that say that it went up into the 20th century. Which is really interesting of this particular ceremony. Obviously, the nature of it is disputed. Some say, well, it was clearly like equivalent to same-sex marriage, but some say, oh no, they were chaste and it was strictly platonic and it was just friends.
Who was chasing who, Johnny?
Well, indeed, it sounds like a great time. But yeah, obviously it would be anachronistic to say that Adelphopoiesis is the same as same-sex marriage, because obviously terms like, or ideas like sexuality and stuff like that weren't a thing back then. But I think it's probably, to kind of put it in today's parlance, to say that it is same-sex marriage is a kind of fair summation. And I like these two saints, not necessarily because of being in the Roman Empire or anything like that, but because they are two strongly venerated saints who are both men who were very close and probably lovers, even if they weren't married, that pederastic relationship would have meant that they were essentially having sex with each other. And it shows that historically the church has not always been anti-gay, which I think is great. And indeed, I mean, in medieval times, the church owned brothels, and some of those brothels were attached to bishops' palaces. And the sex workers in them were both male and female, and only men really frequented these places. So there are lots of different parts of history that really show that queerness hasn't always been an issue. And I quite like Sergius and Bacchus for that, because they're kind of up there as a paired, you know, two saints together who kind of almost speak out, speaking truth to power, Adam. Against the church's current stance, or on the whole current stance to, yeah, same-sex relationships, really.
It reminds me a bit of, you know, the David and Jonathan thing.
Yeah.
Theologically speaking, I totally understand that, like, it's a bit anachronistic to be like, oh, they were gay, and, you know, that's not really a concept that, you know, it would have made sense in that culture, blah, blah, blah. But also... they're definitely gay. It's impossible to not see it as them being gay now. Like, I get that maybe that might be me putting my, like, modern lens onto the stuff, but also, you know, that's what we do, right? We can only read it from our own context. And for my context, they're gay as hell. Like,
yeah.
The very least we can say is that if what you're saying is anachronistic, then, like, the opposite would be anachronistic too. People who are really sure that there was absolutely nothing going on between David and Jonathan because that would be bad, and you know, because it would be gay and being gay is bad. Like, that's just reading a very modern mindset onto it as well.
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting, actually, this might come as an absolute surprise to people, that for my undergrad, I did my dissertation on masturbation.
Yeah. I love how many of the sentences that you say on this podcast, Johnny, are, this may come as a surprise to people. And it's like, not even close.
Nah. But yeah, and one of the key books for it actually was a book on the history of masturbation. And the author basically argues that things like masturbation and other sexual taboos weren't an issue before the Enlightenment. Like, for masturbation, they pinpoint a 1712 essay as one of the earliest things they could find that talks about masturbation as being an issue. And it was basically a quack surgeon basically saying, oh, if you do that, all these ailments will happen. Oh, and by the way, my friend has the cures for those ailments.
Oh, there.
Just to let you know. And it kind of built up from that period. And it's the same for anything really to do with sex. The Enlightenment, in some ways, was one of the worst things to happen to the world.
There's that postmodernism, eh?
Oh, absolutely. Well, that, you know, the Enlightenment and, you know, Christianity being aligned with the Roman Empire, they were the kind of two really bad things for Christianity.
People probably already know this, but I think it has to be said every time the topic comes up that cornflakes were invented originally to stop people masturbating.
Yep. And I eat them every day.
Is that what you're meant to do with them?
And moving swiftly onwards. I think that's the end of that topic. Thank you for saying it, Johnny.
Julie, soften it with the milk first, Adam.
No, I thought the idea was to prevent it. I mean, they are very crunchy, so...
The gluten-free ones are even crunchier.
Thanks for that tip.
So, to return a bit to our main topic, we've talked a little bit about some of the pressures that a professional Christian might experience that would lead them to take a both sides approach. But I think there's also something else at play here, which is the way that certain, to be a cliche Marxist, I'm going to use the term hegemonic forms of Christian theology kind of lead us towards a kind of both sidesism. And I think, you know, you mentioned about praying for your enemy, Johnny. And I think that's a really, you know, what you spell out there is a way for that not to lead to both sidesisms. But I think there is a tendency within Christian theology to, you know, to take those ideas about praying for your enemy, about universality, and actually use it as a way to avoid particularity and taking sides and to talk about things in general terms.
I know, Adam, you spoke earlier about communion, and it was the sort of preamble before I think we started recording. I can't remember. And I wonder, I'm just thinking, because in preparation for the episode, the Liturgies from Below has a
great
communion
book.
Liturgy. Absolutely.
Who's that by again?
Claudio Calvales.
Yep.
Did I pronounce his surname right?
Probably. I mean, I think it's like Carvalhes, but either way, it's a great book, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes.
And I do try and use it as much as possible, and I kind of preface saying, you know, these are prayers and liturgies and poems and things like that written by people in the global south, people quite often from oppressed places, and using them means that we can be praying with them and be in solidarity in a way with them. But one of the Eucharistic prayers, one of the lines in it, which I've used a couple of times, it just kind of slips in there. It says, in penitence for the ways in which their blood is poured out for us, for our complicity in the sacrifices of the new covenant of global capitalism, which is a beautiful
Amen.
Line. And yeah. And there's a kind of real tension in the room the two times I've used that. I haven't explored what that tension is, whether it's a realization, whether it's I totally disagree. Though I imagine if people totally disagreed, they would have approached me about it, maybe.
But there's something about using the voice of someone else and caveating it with that by saying, we're saying this prayer that has been written by someone or people in the Global South, and this is their experience of life, that kind of legitimizes what you're saying. Because it's not, it is you saying it, but it's actually, it's not you saying it as well. It's someone else saying it. And how are you going to come and speak over the voice of someone whose lived experience of capitalism is that it's completely screwed them and their family and their loved ones, you know?
I suspect part of that tension is that we have a Christianity now that is a very spiritualized religion, which sounds like a, I don't know, an unnecessary qualifier, right? Of course, religion is spiritual. But what I mean by that is that a religion that has, particularly in the modern world, withdrawn from issues of actual material reality into the realm of spiritual sustenance, I guess. And, you know, occasionally it'll jump in to tell us not to allow euthanasia or be anti-gay. But even, you know, even forms of spirituality that are not socially conservative, or forms of Christianity, I should say, that are not socially conservative, are still largely spiritualized. And the ways in which it might interact with real world political realities are very cautious, are very tenuous. But actually, we know that Christianity for a long time was a deeply political religion, both anti-political ruling powers, and then unfortunately, being part of Christian ruling powers, quote-unquote Christian ruling powers, I guess. But, and actually, in some ways, that spiritualization is a reaction to the role Christianity has played in colonialism, in, you know, creating empires and all the rest of it. I think you lose something by spiritualizing that Christianity away from the real world.
Well, it creates a Christianity that reflects the culture that it's in. Like, that's what mainstream Christianity does for the most part. So in the UK, mainstream Christianity looks remarkably British because the people practicing it, for the most part, are British. You know, Christianity in the UK looks very different to Christianity in Cuba. You know, looks very different to Christianity in China, looks very different to Christianity in Greece. And all of these Christianities will, for the most part, reflect the culture they're in, the good stuff and the bad stuff. And I think for me, it's about, as a Christian, being able to take a step back from that and say, not actually necessarily that the cultural influence on my form of Christianity is inherently a bad thing, but it is to be able to contextualize it. Right, to say, well, where does this come from? Where to examine myself and my Christianity? Because actually, Christianity is broader than what I think of it. It's even broader than, you know, what I think of it in terms of, you know, it's I see it as a very kind of left wing, notwithstanding that that's an anachronistic term, but basically a very left wing religion, right? I think. Actually, a lot of religions start out as a kind of socio-political and religious movement for change, you know, either through reform or revolution, responding to the cultures at the time. And then they've gradually been assimilated into the cultures that they found themselves in. Right. And so, yeah, I want to be able to take that step back and examine my Christianity and work out which parts of it are reflective of the culture that I'm in and which parts of it are things that are authentically Christian in a sense.
One of the things that I think mainstream Christianity would have a big problem with is your description of Christianity as a left-wing religion, not just because it's a left-wing religion. It would actually have the same problem if you describe it as a right-wing religion.
Yeah.
It sees religion as something that is beyond politics, that escapes the clutches of these nasty little political realities.
Yes.
And I think it therefore becomes really easy to say, well, you know, you've got all these politics and maybe it's nice to take part, but actually you know, if I'm a professional Christian, these are unimportant questions of who's right or who's wrong in the Israel-Palestine situation. Actually, what's important is matters of spirituality. And yeah, we might do some nice things, say some prayers, raise some money. We have limited forms of political engagement still, but ultimately we transcend those political realities to a more important spiritual reality.
But isn't that just doing what I said that it was doing in the first place? You know, reflecting the culture that it's in. And the culture that it's in says that ultimately the only things that are actually political are, you know, going to the polls every 4 or 5 years and, you know, maybe listening to the news at, you know, 6 or 10 o'clock. And then that's about it.
One of the benefits I think that Methodism has.
Oh, here he goes, talking about Methodism again.
I know, it's awful.
We ain't converting, Johnny. Well, maybe.
Says the person going to a Methodist church. But I think one of the benefits for me in terms of going against what's happening in many ways is going back to a lot of Methodist history of being really quite active in going against oppressive regimes, whether that had been slavery, whether that be poverty, whether that be anything that harms people.
I cannot believe you've missed the opportunity to list the Church of England amongst the oppressive regimes Methodism has gone against there. That's such a missed chance, yeah.
It was true. But in the early days, the Wesley brothers didn't want to separate from the Church of England.
Yeah, one of their worst decisions.
Clearly. But almost having what has been, and that thing that has been being valued, and drawing upon it and going, well, look, these people did some really interesting things. Surely we should be doing that too. Kind of makes people go, oh. And it's, I guess, trying to find those things that help people think about it without just kind of going, oh no, that's awful liberal bullshit, you know.
I think that can be valuable, but I guess where I would sort of urge caution, and I've said this before on the podcast, so, you know, people might want to just skip a few minutes.
Don't tell them they've got that option.
But no, I mean, this is something that I was, when I still thought myself capable of doing a PhD, my PhD was essentially about tracing a certain brand of political thought through the church, and yes, specifically the Church of England, but other churches as well. And it was a brand of political thought that essentially labeled itself Christian socialist, but actually was a very conservative response to continental, mostly continental Marxism, but certainly continental forms of socialism that actually did want deep structural change, right? And the issue I have both with the Church of England and with the Methodist Church, starting certainly in the 1800s, arguably, you know, before we see that rise of the Christian socialist movement as it came to be known, we saw this movement as something that was quite deliberately saying, well, we need to make these changes, or the Marxists are going to, or the real radicals are going to get in, and they're actually going to change stuff properly, right? And so, for me, absolutely, use some of that stuff, use some of that tradition, if that's helpful. But I don't think we should ever be under the illusion that the vast majority of that was a very conservative form of what you might call socialism, if you're feeling generous.
And yeah, and I agree. It shouldn't be the only tool we rely on either. Actually, it's a bit like the other episode we were talking about of having a whole array of tools in which we can do this thing.
And one of those tools should be a pitchfork.
Yeah.
That was a call for revolution, damn it! Like...
With a resounding, yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
What the hell is this podcast? What has it become?
Do you want me to do a proper version of it, Adam?
Go on in.
Two of those tools should be the hammer and the sickle.
Hey! Yeah, I suppose a pitchfork is a much more kind of rural anarchist kind of symbol, isn't it? So
Yeah.
Reverting to type there.
And those tools will be a centralised bureaucracy. On that note, I think we're going to draw the episode to a close. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. Thank you for joining me, Johnny and Adam. It has been a pleasure as always. Adam, where in the world can people find you?
You can find me most places at CommieXIAN.
Johnny, I know that you don't usually plug any internet presence, but I will say that you forgot to plug that you wrote an interesting piece reflecting on some of the themes from last week that we posted on the blog on the website that has until very recently been long dormant, that is mostly just old articles Adam wrote a while ago. But there's a really interesting piece reflecting on some of those postmodern ideas that we talked about last week that you can read if you want to hear more from Johnny. You can also find this podcast in all your usual podcast feedy places. Please do get in touch with us because we love to hear from people. All our contact details are in the description. They're also on our website, breadandrosaries.com, where you can find all sorts of wonderful things like our Patreon and our shop. And if you have a spare minute, you can also rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all those places. Thank you very much, everyone. We will see you next time, and rest assured, we will keep the Cenotaph safe. Goodbye, everyone.
See you later.
Bye.
In that essentially Lou is the only one left properly in the fold, right?
That's true. I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't even know what I am. Johnny's a Methodist, Lou's Anglican, and you're not even Christian, so...
If only. No, I don't think I really mean that.
Is this you proclaiming your love for the Muslim Brotherhood again?